Hello and welcome to Frame to Frame. I'm Andy Williams.
I'm Sean Wilson.
And this week we're discussing rock mock docs, so mock rockumentaries. As we announced on Twitter on Friday, we're going to be focusing on the seminal This Is Spinal Tap and the Lonely Island's relatively recent pop star Never Stop Poppin'. Now, Sean, tell me about your relationship to these two films.
In the case of Spinal Tap, it's one of those movies that you hear about probably when you're a teenager. As a teenager, whenever someone tells you, like a parent or a friend or whatever, whenever someone tells you that you have to watch something, automatically you take up a bit of resistance to it. You know what I mean by this? It's kind of like, the more someone recommends something, the less I'm inclined to watch it.
I had the exact same thing with Ed Sheeran. The more someone tells me that I would like his music, the less inclined I was to listen to him. And hey, I was right.
I was going to say there's no amount of bargaining would get me to listen. But anyway, that's an argument for another time. I must have watched Spinal Tap when I was a teenager, and very, very quickly I just became aware of, just by seeing it, the influence that it had on, we were talking about this earlier, shows like The Office, and I was like, wow, this is really funny, really, really funny. My relationship to Popstar has been formed very, very recently because I only watched it for the first time within the last few days.
Excellent. This is what we wanted to do on this podcast. We didn't just want to watch films that we've already seen and just wax lyrical about absolute classics, even though that's kind of what we've done so far.
Yes.
We want to try and challenge each other and watch things that may... Like, there's no way you would have actually sat down to say, you know what, I'm going to watch this Lonely Island movie from whenever it was, a couple of years ago.
2016, yeah.
But I'm glad someone does some research.
Oh no, I've got some notes on the screen. We call it research.
I'm glad one of us has.
I mean, I was trying to remember why I didn't watch this Popstar when it came out. I mean, it came out in 2016. It didn't do spectacularly well at the box office. Looking at it, it made its budget back. Maybe it was released at the wrong time. I mean, it's anyone's guess, isn't it? Really. Whereas obviously, This Is Spinal Tap has only increased its reputation and prestige in the 3.5 decades since it's been made.
Well, I think there's an interesting point there, is that, and not to sort of preempt the discussions that we're going to have, is that Spinal Tap wasn't a huge hit on release either. And I'm not saying that in 35 years' time we're going to look back at Popstar the same way people look back at Spinal Tap now. But it is interesting that also flopped relatively on release. It wasn't a huge hit, and it's gathered the pace since. I think there's potentially something more suited to home viewing about these sorts of things, maybe due to their sort of cinema verite style. Hey, I did a media degree.
I can never tell. I think that's the first time I've heard cinema verite used in an ironic, non-ironic fashion for 20 years.
Yeah, trying to class up the podcast, what can I say?
No, but I know what you mean. I mean, Spinal Tap in particular makes a virtue of the fact that it's not meant to look cinematic. It is meant to look like someone has captured an idiotic rock group on the fly, and it gives you that kind of candid, intimate quality to it. Hence what we were saying earlier about The Office. Like, the beauty of something like The Office is that it's been de-glammed, it's been thoroughly de-glamorized, and that is part of the appeal, yet it's also part of the very, very cringy kind of nature to it. You don't get that Hollywood gloss in Spinal Tap, and you don't get that kind of distance in The Office either. And it's kind of like, okay, so you're laughing at Spinal Tap while wincing a lot as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's the template, isn't it? And I think, was it Reiner's first as a director?
Yeah, and
because he opens it with breaking the fourth wall with himself on screen, so that's a bold move in and of itself. I think we're kind of moving into to discussing the film. So we're going to be discussing Spinal Tap first, and afterwards we'll go into Popstar Never Stop Poppin'. But before we sort of go into sort of the nitty-gritty, Sean, why don't you tell us a little bit about the setup and narrative of Spinal Tap?
So essentially, 1984 mockumentary film in which you have a film crew that follows the eponymous rock group as they as they go on tour, played by the likes of Christopher Guest and Harry Shearer, all of whom went on to, you know, have gone on to very, very successful film careers. And it's all about the album, various album creations, the various tours that they do. The film crew follows them like candid camera style, really. And it brilliantly skewers the egotism and the hubris that so many of rock musicians obviously exhibit, and it does it quite ruthlessly as well. I have to be honest, it's making me grin just thinking about it now. I mean, it's not just the observations about the music, it's the incidental backstage details are often the funniest thing about it. That's where I think it really comes to life. When Spinal Tap are away from the crowds and you see how what jerks they are, really. I mean, there's how these go out to 11, like that's
I was wondering how long it'd take for you to do a Mockney accent.
Yeah, exactly. Why don't you just make 10 louder and make 10 the loudest? These go out to 11.
It's not louder, yeah. I think one of the true highlights of the film for me is, like you say, when they're not on stage is when they're actually trying to find the stage.
Yeah, and they pass the backstage like caretaker about five times.
Yeah, and they ask him for direction. That was the bit, but in terms of sort of broad spectrum of the film, I don't admire it as much as some other people.
See, and you kept this quiet, and this is going to become a running theme now. We'll broadly agree on a topic, and when we get down into the nitty gritty, there will be, let's say, little chasms that will open up, little alleyway.
Completely disagree. We've got to find something to disagree.
Yeah,
on,
yeah.
But the point of it being that I think that there are individual moments in this that are great, but there is also a lot that is just people talking without a script or just a camera running and hoping for some gold. And it's that improvisational style of comedy that we saw a resurgence of in the sort of mid-noughties with Judd Apatow movies. And when it works, it really works, but there's a lot of hit and miss. So even at, what is it, like 90 minutes, there were parts of the film where I was like, come on. Bearing in mind, I've seen this probably about 3 or 4 times now over the course of like 10, 12 years, something like that. So, you know, I've given it a fair good run, I think, but I just don't find it as wholeheartedly funny or wall-to-wall funny as what I think it's being portrayed as a lot of the time.
Well, true to form, I agree with your broad point about improvisational comedy, but I don't agree with what you said about improvisational comedy as related to this film. When you look at it, I think the Judd Apatow comparison is fantastic, actually, because I find that approach really, really tiresome in Judd Apatow comedies. It's not helped by the fact that his films tend to be over 2 hours long, when, like Spinal Tap, they should be about 90 minutes. And that I find really infuriating. I think, actually, one of the things I do like about Spinal Tap is that it isn't very long. I think the material is very, very well tailored to the length. But I think the characters are so brilliant. I mean, one of my favourites is, I think, is it Nigel Tufnell with the small bread when he's got the catering behind the scenes? He's like, well, look at this bread. You can't fold it over. You can't do anything with it. And then you get he's got the miniature bread with the ham in it. He's like, no, look, it's all breaking up. You can't do that. And that is kind of like banal little. I mean, that looked. I imagine that was improvised. If it was improvised, that's very, very funny. There are, there are the broader gags. I mean, when he's holding forth about being a very, very eloquent musician, then Rob Ray goes, oh, what's that called? That's called Lick My Love Pump, which is kind of like the, see, there you go, you see laughter. And I mean, it needs the build up, but yeah.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree with you. Like I said, there are bits of it that are really, really funny. But I just, you know, everyone points to the, it goes up to 11, and things like how they can ridicule the mythical sense of sort of pop or heavy metal rock at the sort of mid 70s early 80s, you know, the things like Stonehenge being a place of mystery and all those sorts of things. And I get the humour, and there's points where I think the humour really works, and there's other points where I think it just kind of doesn't. So
I mean, I wonder...
Just a personal thing.
Yeah, yeah. I wonder whether maybe... Weirdly, the film's impact might have been diluted because there are so many imitators. There are so many things that owe themselves to this. And I wonder if that might retrospectively have like a knock-on effect. What I will say is I think we were talking about sort of humorous tastes earlier, tastes in comedy. I think the sublime thing about Spinal Tap is that never for one... it occupies a brilliant... that quite subtle and witty position, which is when I watch it, I'm never quite sure, you know, is this real or is it fake? Because obviously it's got that mockumentary format, and I think the comedy is pitched at such a brilliant level. It's just caricatured enough to be funny, yet it's just subtle enough to actually make you go, hang on a minute, I could actually genuinely believe this is real. And that it is not the same reaction I had to our other film that we're going to be discussing this evening. I had a very, very different response to that one.
Well, it's interesting that you say that. So I was watching this the other night in preparation for this podcast, and my wife was sat on the sofa doing some work on her laptop. So she was sort of looking up every so often, and it was about half an hour in, she looked and went, is this based on real people? Is this actually a real documentary? And for a long, long time, I was just not going to say anything, but she could sort of tell. So, like I say, it would work as a documentary. And I guess if anybody's seen Anvil as well,
that's a great film.
They kind of build as the real life Spinal Tap. And again, with the Bross documentary, the Screaming Never Stops or something, whatever it was called, there's elements of that ridiculousness, of the self-absorbed nature of musicians. But yeah, I mean, Spinal Tap worked on some levels, and you know, you look at Rob Reiner as a director, especially sort of mid to late 80s, moving into the early 90s. He went on a great run. I mean, we talked about runs on a previous podcast, but to have Spinal Tap, Stand By Me, Princess Bride, When Harry Met Sally, Misery, and A Few Good Men, all within sort of like 8 years.
Yeah. I'm trying to think what the film was that broke that streak. It might have been North with Bruce Willis and Elijah Wood. Yeah, it prompted one of Roger Ebert's most brilliantly vitriolic reviews ever. I can't remember if that's the one where he said, you know, it doesn't scrape the bottom of the barrel. It doesn't even deserve to be mentioned in the same sentence as Barrels. He might have been talking about that, or he might have been talking about something else. I think he might have
Roger Ebert suggested that the film was so poorly written that even the best child actor would look bad in it.
Ooh, what an ignominious end for Rob Reiner's Lucky Street. I mean, again, that's the kind of brilliantly withering quote that you could imagine a critic within Spinal Tap saying. It's somewhat ironically, I think that one of the great things about Spinal Tap, I mean, obviously the humorous observations about stagecraft, about the ridiculously overblown stagecraft of a lot of, I mean, obviously it came out in 1984, so what would that have been, like the glam rock era?
Yeah. So sort of like Kiss eras, apparently. So I did do some prep. Aerosmith's album, right before this was released, actually had a picture of Stonehenge on the front cover.
I didn't know that. Amazing.
So lead singer Steven Tyler just failed to see any humour in the film at all. Because he's like, well, yeah, and? What about this?
That's amazing. But the whole, obviously there's the famous scene when they're on, they're meant to come out of those like pods on stage, and then he gets his arm stuck in the pods, and then
the bit out of that that made me laugh the most was not only when he was stuck in there, but the fact that they inverted right at the end of the song, that they went back into the pods just as he came out. I thought that was...
And all the roadies are kind of like scurrying around, just trying to, again, the simulation of reality is very, very well done. The attention to detail is brilliant. I think that earmarked Rob Reiner is a really good director, obviously up until North. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, sure. Let's just you know, take a massive stab at North, why don't we, whilst we're at it? Yeah.
I haven't seen it.
And he hasn't really recovered, no, being honest.
He did The American President, though, didn't he? That was good.
He did.
Yeah, that was a really nice film.
He's done The Bucket List. Moving swiftly on.
Yeah.
He went on a great streak in the mid-80s to the mid-90s. Yeah. Let's just say that. But, you know, there's all sorts of cameos across the film. I spotted Billy Crystal as a waiter, mainly because of his voice. I spotted Fred Willard on the Air Force base that they're playing towards the end, which is where... Is it Nigel that just sort of storms off stage, yeah, just throws it on? Dana Carvey's in there somewhere. You know, it's just for the time, I think they were getting Ed Begley Jr.'s around. Like, they were getting who they could for the film, especially when you consider it's a first-time director.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's terrific. I don't think it's dated at all. I think that because it's poking fun at the look and style of, you know, glam rockers. I mean, a lot of those overblown principles still apply to pop stars now. Of course they do. That's how musicians still make an impact, by cultivating this kind of image of pretentiousness. And I think the movie was very, very ahead of its time. Well, what's the album that they? It might have been. I think it was after Spinal Tap. Was it the album like Break Like the Wind that they did? Because they reformed, didn't they? And they came back together to do Break Like the Wind. And they say, you know, it screams maturity, motherfucker.
I'm gonna have to put the explicit thing on this again.
Yeah, you are. Sorry about that. Sorry. This is rated 15 this podcast. Actually, no, it would be rated 12 because I've only said that the F word once so far, so you can get away with 12.
Let's not get into the nitty-gritty of the BBFC rating. According to most podcast streaming apps, it's either explicit or not.
Oh, okay. So it's in binary. Okay, fair enough.
Yeah. Odd being computers. One thing that I did take away from this watching of it was right at the end when David and Derek discussed what they're going to be doing in the future. And they mention a musical theatre production based on Jack the Ripper. I actually want to see that.
I would really want
to see that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we got about Sweeney Todd, right? So,
yeah.
You know.
Just Sweeney Todd just turned up to 11. Just imagine that. It'd be amazing.
Sure, yeah. Let's go with amazing on that one. But, you know, if Rob Reiner really wanted to scrape the barrel, then just go back and make that and just do it as the characters. Yeah, I mean, we still got Christopher Guest, Harry Shearer, and Michael McKean. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Throwing that out there.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, we can't possibly understate the legacy that Spinal Tap has. You know, the fact that so many actual musicians have watched it, so and referenced it, like REM have said how close it is to their early years. Judas Priest sort of commented on the fact that they've had a number of drummers as well as Spinal, like that was, they, I think they called it Spinal Tap worthy. You know, Eddie Vedder has referenced it. There's all sorts of musicians that have discussed the film. I think I read an interview once with back when from Nirvana, and Kurt Cobain said that there's no good music films, and Dave Grohl came in and said, oh, except Spinal Tap, of course. And Kurt said, yeah, of course, obviously Spinal Tap. So I think everyone within the industry that it's representing really does enjoy and recognize themselves or elements of themselves in each of the characters. So I don't think we can understate quite the legacy that it has. And it's clearly got that for a reason, regardless of my views or not.
Agreed.
any chance to undercut me? Yeah.
Well, now's your chance to undercut me with our second film that we're going to be talking about.
Excellent.
So,
well, Never Stop Poppin', which is the mockumentary from The Lonely Island. So The Lonely Island are a comedy music band. They tend to sort of focus on on wrappings. They were a little bit different to Spinal Tap. But this film is centered on Connor for Real, who was previously in a band himself and sort of broke out onto his own sort of stage, taking all the credit for what the band did prior to that. But he is now sort of the breakout star and sort of coming to the mid to late point of his career, right where he might need some help from his previous style boys. So I've seen this film a couple of times. Sean, you've seen this film for the first time. Tell me what you thought.
Well, I thought it was broadly entertaining. I mean, on the basis of it making me laugh, it worked. I laughed pretty consistently and loudly all the way through. But the point that I made earlier was I was laughing in a very, very different way from Spinal Tap. I think I was laughing in this because this movie was straining a lot harder to make me laugh. And this the effort of the humour in this movie was much more apparent. In Spinal Tap, it's effortless. It's so well observed and it's so convincing. It convinces you so much in Spinal Tap that what you're watching is real, that it becomes really funny and also kind of unsettling as well. In this, I never for 1 minute, it didn't drop the veil of being a kind of cartoonish, caricatured depiction of a pop group, despite the fact that it's got the mockumentary, rockumentary, whatever you want to call it, format draped over it. I was never for 1 minute fooled by the fact that what it is a Judd Apatow-produced sort of fairly broad cartoonish comedy that just happens to use that framework. And I say that saying I did laugh. I laughed pretty solidly. And I think there were some very, very good jabs in it. I mentioned after I'd watched it, I WhatsApped you and I said that probably the best bit in the whole film, which I thought was spot on, was the I'm not gay scene, song that he does, that Andy Samberg's character does, which is, it's so spot on because within that genre of music, singers are so clear to define their apparent heterosexual qualities. I mean, you hear it in practically all of those songs, and the way they get that is really good. To be honest, I could have done with more of that kind of razor sharp satire. I thought the rest of the film was kind of like a sort of soft target, again, kind of broad thing, and I didn't think there was anything particularly surprising about the humor, but I think through the process of attrition, by just grinding my funny bone down into dust, there were some general, I mean, like Maya Rudolph, who I like very much, turns up as the person who's gonna stick their music into a host of like white goods refrigerators. Yeah. And she's not called Deborah, she's called Deborah, and like where does Deborah come from? It comes from Deborah, just so you know, like that. And then that obviously all goes horribly wrong. That gimmick about putting their music into all the white goods goes horribly wrong and it causes like a global blackout or something. It's just that's funny. I like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you're saying is got, I would agree with, basically, to an extent. I think that they do go after some low-hanging fruit, and I think they completely shotgun that low-hanging fruit. So there's a scene where they go to the Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon. Now, I don't know if anybody has watched clips on YouTube of Jimmy Fallon, but what they do on the show, or what they do in the film, as represented it sort of in the show, it's absolutely spot on. They pretend that Connor doesn't really know what's going to be going on. They say, oh, no, now how about you do your infamous dance from the 1990s? Why don't we do the donkey roll? And he's like, no, I don't want to be doing that. And then, yeah, come on, let's get one of the other members of the band out. And Jimmy is then donkey rolling with the two previous members of the Starboys. And it's just a little bit cringy. And that's exactly what the Tonight Show does, and that's exactly what's expected of artists when they go on that. Come on, just play the hits. Let's just go through all the old stuff, whatever it takes to get likes and views on YouTube. So I thought there was some nuance to what they were saying. But I do broadly agree with what you're saying as well.
I mean, there was one there was one other bit, which is apparently was lampooning an American tabloid series called TMZ that I wasn't familiar with and that I had to look it up after. In the film, presumably for legal purposes, they're called CMZ. And
you don't know TMZ?
No. Honestly, I'm so out of the loop. Yeah, so I told you this would be your chance to undermine me. I had no idea what that scene was based on. They've got like a load of people like sort of laughing maniacally together while passing like product placement beverages onto each other. I didn't get that at all. And I think that is an example of how this movie goes after. Spinal Tap is universal. Spinal Tap has got kind of universal humor in it. This one goes after very, very specific pop culture targets that, for my money, will probably date quite quickly. Whereas Spinal Tap hasn't dated because it doesn't do that. It takes the general canvas of like rock music, the construction of music, the stagecraft, the backstage stuff, and so on. I mean, this movie does do that, and I have to say, I do like Lonely Island. I'm aware of Lonely Island. I mean, the whole warning, explicit alert here. The whole Jizz in My Pants song is very funny. I mean, it's a brilliant pastiche of Pet Shop Boys. It's very, very good. And the song,
there's a load of the songs that you can point to that are great. I'm on a boat.
Yeah, yeah.
I threw it on the ground. Yeah. Like, but my personal favorite from the film is the Bin Laden song because it's just so abhorrent, and it's one of those things of like, did they really say that? But it's on that right line. It's kind of the only thing that's ever made me feel the same has been when I went to see the Book of Mormon.
Right.
It's on that line of, can they say that? They just said that. Oh, in retrospect, that's kind of okay, but
I thought you were going to say then, I thought you were going to draw a comparison with something by Sacha Baron Cohen, like Borat, where you're kind of like, oh, you know, he's treading the fine line there between, you know,
I can see that. But there was a moment, I'll just tell the story on the podcast just as well. There was a moment where my phone was connected to our car and my wife was sat in the car outside a fish and chip shop. It was a warm day, so the windows were down. So well, always a storyteller. On my phone, I put the Bin Laden song and turned it up as loud as I could. And I just turned out to see her in the car and she's just flailing around trying her best to turn it off. So I thoroughly recommend anybody watching this film just to imagine that particular microcosm of a scene where someone's flailing around trying to turn off this. You know, it's not necessarily something you'd want to listen to with your parents. So, Mum, if you're listening, don't watch the film.
I mean, I think what the moral of the story is that people are taking away from this is that there have been two stories at the expense of your wife within this podcast. That she is the sympathetic figure in this, this whole thing. So,
yeah, I should keep her out.
Yeah, it's basically like, just don't watch mockumentaries when you're around, or don't listen to mockumentary soundtracks when you're around, basically. But
what can you say?
Yeah, going back to the film, I liked it. I thought the show was stolen by Akiva Schaffer, who is the director, who plays the third member of the group, Lawrence, who has basically left the group and has gone to become a farmer / amateur carpenter. And he's got all of his like woodworking skills, if they can be so called. I thought that was very funny. Also, the jibes at the that kind of Daft Punk ostentatiousness, because the Giacomo Taccone, is that the name of the one of the actors in Lonely Island? Hang on a minute, I'm gonna
Contact.
Owen, yes. He's given this basically like Darth Vader style mask that is sort of, then all he has to do is basically stand behind, put this mask on and just flick through an iPod. That is,
he just turned an iPod on. That's what it is.
It's just, it's all bluster and it's all show. I thought there were very, very well observed gags, but I think it owes a huge debt to Spinal Tap. I mean, Spinal Tap is kind of writ large through the whole thing. The problem with it was I didn't believe in it the way that I believed in Spinal Tap. And I think that is the nub of it for me.
Yeah, there's no hiding it. It's juvenile. It's sort of stupid on many levels. It's aiming at the low-hanging fruit. It hits the low-hanging fruit, for my money, pretty consistently. But I mean, there's certain bits in there which are just hilarious. Like I think you mentioned previously to me about the moment with Seal and trained wolves.
That was brilliant.
And you know, it is a bit more reliant on actual celebrities and cameos in comparison to Spinal Tap. I know that Spinal Tap sort of had people of the day, whereas now you've got in Popstar, you've got Paul McCartney, Seal, Martin Sheen, Ed Sheeran, Ringo Starr, Adam Levine,
Mariah Carey,
Simon Cowell, Akon. Do you know what I mean? There's a whole list of people that you can go through.
The one person I did want to cite, who I think has obviously got a very, very good sense of humour, is Justin Timberlake, who plays Tyrus, who's chef and at one point, you know, he's just there in the background and he's like singing and he's told to just cut the carrots more quietly.
Leave it to the professionals. Leave singing to the professionals.
Although that's very funny. I mean, Mariah Carey, you know, has a crack about it. At her own apparently humble status, that's quite near the beginning of the film. I thought that's funny, getting her involved. Yeah, I mean, there's a dizzying amount of cameos in it. I mentioned there's one bit where Connor gets into a random fight with Martin Sheen. Martin Sheen gets violent with him and tackles him to the floor, which is very funny. Again, it's kind of...
It's low-hanging fruit. It's there. It's relatively easy.
Yeah.
But when it's only easy when it's done well. It's kind of like a really, really good Victoria Sponge that, because it's easy, people just said, oh, yeah, it's Victoria Sponge. But a Victoria Sponge is still very nice.
Because you have to get the ratio of jam to cream exactly right. Otherwise,
absolutely.
Yeah, I like that analogy. Yeah.
Let's not discuss whether jam or cream go on first.
That's something else entirely. Yeah, yeah. And I am from the Southwest. I'll take it personally. So,
can I just say, though, no soundtrack has ever... not been improved by the inclusion of Michael Bolton.
Well, yeah, I mean, I saw Michael Bolton on it because Michael Bolton has contributed to a few of the Honest trailers from the Screen Junkies, which are very, very funny. And I think Michael Bolton has clearly got a very good sense of humour. If you check out the Honest trailer for anyone listening to this, check out the Honest trailer for Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory and check out Michael Bolton's covers of the various songs that are in the... you know, Come With Me, Join Me in a World of Safety Violations, which is very, very... But yeah, I really like seeing him in this because it just reinforces that he's obviously, he can laugh at himself, which is great.
So, well, I think between both this and Teen Titans Go to the Movies with upbeat inspirational song about life.
That's right, yeah.
As voiced by Michael Bolton, and it's perfect, and it's just an amazing moment in that film, which, by the way, is much better than it ever got credit for. So I humbly recommend that anybody goes to watch Teen Titans Go to the Movies.
Yeah, it is very
just
funny.
Just veering off a different topic.
Yeah.
We might get to it one day of comic book movies that aren't really comic book movies, but you never know. We'll have to find some other, you know, ridiculous theme to try and tie them together.
Yeah.
But Popsos, that sounds like a relatively broad thumbs up from you, Sean.
Yeah, yeah. It's not to go back to Roger Ebert. It's not a wave at Roger Ebert waving thumb. It's broadly thumbs up, yeah.
Excellent. Well, I really, really enjoyed Pops That Never Stop Popping. I enjoyed Spinal Tap. There are moments that I massively enjoyed, and there's moments that was a bit more... Yeah, when they sat around moving back to Spinal Tap, they sat around in a cafe and they're drawing what they want as their, there's sort of this eternal struggle with the band between the lead singer's girlfriend and one of the members of the band. And they're sort of comparing as to what the vision that they both have for the band. And it's just a bit, it goes on for a little long for my taste. And it's just like, right, okay, when's the joke going to happen?
But isn't that part of the beauty of it? Because it's Spinal Tap has got character development in spite of the fact that they're idiots, there are those moments of downtime when you compared to Popstar, which is just basically like a lot of, you know,
set of gags.
Yeah, like hysterical shrieking gags, which again is very much in that kind of Judd Apatow mold. And I know a lot, but the Judd Apatow can do character development. It's not fair to suggest that he can't do that. I mean, like Knocked Up I actually think is pretty good.
And This Is 40, I think, is massively underrated.
Yeah, yeah, and 40-Year-Old Virgin. Funny People. Funny People, yeah. But I think that Spinal Tap comes from a different place. Spinal Tap comes from, you know, a real, like you said earlier, a real acute awareness from inside the industry, which is, you know, as far as I'm aware, Rob Reiner wasn't affiliated with the music industry, but you'd think that he was because it's so very, very well observed. I mean, one of the things I did like about Popstar was the observations about the sort of sanctimonious entourage that follow Connor around when he goes on his solo tour. He has all the Wranglers. You'll be able to remember like what various ones there are. What's an example?
He gives them a sandwich.
Yeah,
that's one of the moments that I quite enjoyed. So you've got one of the fellas from The Inbetweeners.
Yeah, that's right. Yes.
they just kind of they sycophantically follow him around and just do whatever they can for a free ride. And he tests them by giving them a sandwich with something not particularly savoury in it. And whoever tells him that it's not very nice is the one that you sort of like, yeah, you can stick around. And, you know, I think that those moments work. I think when you look at somebody like Justin Bieber, who there's clearly influences of him in Connor. And I just, yeah, the film is much more broad. The film is, generally speaking, looking for a wider audience, especially than a wider audience than it got. But it's a Lonely Island film. It's sort of in keeping. It's childish, it's ridiculous, and it's going after kind of low-hanging fruit. But they achieve it.
I was just going to say, I thought of one of those Wranglers, one of those sort of lackeys that he has following him around. There's like a perspective lackey, someone who's shorter than he is, and who stands next to him at premieres to make him look bigger. That gag I thought was funny. Like those kind of, you know, observations.
it is that kind of ridiculous humour, which I quite enjoy. I like silly. I like ridiculous. But anyone who's sort of thinking, who are the Lonely Island, because we've kind of sort of summed them up as this duo, may know Andy Samberg is one of the members of the Lonely Island, and he is the lead on the TV series Brooklyn Nine-Nine. So it's kind of that level of humour. If you like Brooklyn Nine-Nine, absolutely I'd suggest watching this. And I believe he did something else where he was playing a tennis player.
Oh, okay.
Which I can't remember the name of now, which is particularly unhelpful.
What a comedy film.
He did it. It was for TV.
Oh, right.
It was a little while ago now. It was with Kit Harington.
Oh, right.
7 Days in Hell, it was called.
Right.
And that was also a mockumentary, which was sort of specifically for HBO. And they were playing two tennis players who faced off in the longest match in history.
Right.
And hence the name 7 Days in Hell. That's relatively similar to Popstar, but on a slightly different scale. That's got Michael Sheen in it as well, who is, as we know, a massive friend of our show.
Yes. Yeah. Hello, Michael.
So have you got any final closing thoughts on both Popstar or This Is Spinal Tap?
Well, I'll just say that I think Spinal Tap is one of my favourite comedies. It's masterpiece. I'd say that Popstar is worth another watch, especially given that it didn't do very well when it came out. I mean, if only worth watching for the seal scene, which is very, very funny. And again, it's great to see a big musician like Seal being willing to sort of laugh at themselves like that. I think that's very, very good. Yeah.
I'd thoroughly recommend anybody watching both of these films. It's time well spent, and especially when you consider that watching both of these films could be done in less time than the entirety of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, or pretty much any of Quentin Tarantino's other films.
That's a bit of a jab. Is that a hint at a future theme that we might be doing?
films that we can watch in a space of a Tarantino.
Yeah. I sense there's something you want to get off your chest.
No, just that you need a good editor.
Yeah.
So, the theme for next week's show. So, again, we're trying to keep things relatively specific. We will announce the films on Friday, which is going to be particularly fitting this week. So we're going to be announcing the films themselves on Twitter and on Instagram on Friday, which will be May the 8th. The theme for next week's episode is World War II through child's eyes. So with Friday being the 75th anniversary of VE Day, we wanted to do something to sort of mark this occasion. So we wanted to do World War II films through children's eyes. So, you know, we're looking forward to that. I don't know about you, Sean, but I'm in particular looking forward to this as a theme.
It's always one of the most evocative themes, not just in film, but you look at like literature as well. It's
been a real resurgence lately of the something of Auschwitz.
Yeah.
In terms of writing. So the amount of books that you can see nowadays set in Auschwitz and historical fiction around this time, I think there is a real human interest. So it's kind of switching gears a lot from this week's show.
Yeah, it is. I think to encompass the magnitude of the moment, but also the films we've chosen take very, very different approaches to the subject matter, which is always what I find very, very interesting, like the different medium, how different mediums can tackle something as poetic and as powerful and as sobering as that. Is something that I find very interesting, but looking forward to engaging with the two films we've selected.
Yes, me too, because it's been a long time since I've seen one of them. So it would be nice if you don't ruin one of them this week, Sean. That would be wonderful.
I will uncharacteristically not. I will try my absolute best.
No, you'll just do whatever it takes to get us an explicit rating on iTunes.
Yeah, exactly.
anybody listening to this, by the way, please subscribe to our channel on whichever podcast medium you listen to. Leave us ratings, leave us reviews. If you've got any feedback for us, just let us know. If you want to just hit us up on the old Twitter or the Instagram, our Twitter, which I normally have more prepared than this, I only have two hands.
Well, while you look for that, I'll just say hit us up, or just feel tempted to hit us digitally if you don't agree with what we're saying.
I can't endorse that.
No.
I'm not going to get behind that. But on Twitter, we're there at frame to frame 2. And on Instagram, we're up there as frame_2_frame250. So that's frame to frame with underscores 250 on Instagram, and Twitter at frame to frame with TO with the number 2 at the end. So if there is anything you would like us to cover, any ridiculous themes that you'd like us to encompass in future episodes, then do feel free to do so. Until next Tuesday, which will be when the next one will be up, and the next subject will be the World War II films through children's eyes. Until then, I'm Andy Williams.
I'm Sean Wilson.
Thank you very much for listening. We'll see you next week.
Bye. Bye.